Hi, and welcome to the Climate Minute, your source for insight and perspective on global warming news. My name is Ted McIntyre, and this show is for late April 2023. The global carbon dioxide level is currently 424.6 parts per million. Can you believe it? That's way above the 350 that scientists tell us we need to be at. And on top of that, there's only 2,440 days left until the year 2030, by which time we have to cut our carbon dioxide emissions. Only 2,440 days left. Kind of scary. Well, speaking of time, let me just say that it goes so quickly. Time passes. Dear listener, any of you who have listened to the intro to this show have heard our theme music. I just want to point out that that theme music was composed by my son and a friend of his when they were 8th grade, 12th grade, 10th grade in high school. They recorded that music 2010 or so. We've been using it for 10 years. Well, it turns out that tomorrow, one of those two young men will marry his sweetheart in downtown Boston, and now almost 30. My son will marry his sweetheart in late May. Time's flying. I mean, and 2030 is not that far away. I would just say, so this is sort of a roundabout way of saying, if the production schedule falters over the next month and we don't show up for a week, please be aware we'll be back. And I want to extend my love and congratulations to those two young musicians from so long ago. There you go. Anyway, today we're joined by our friend, the author and educator, Ms. Mariah Tinger. How are you doing, Mariah?
I am doing well, and congratulations to those two musicians. That's exciting. An exciting month ahead for you.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I am looking forward today to talking about a spectrum of solutions for how to address climate change, from reimagined capitalism all the way to sort of a radical overhaul of the economy as we know it. Tune in.
Well, these are exciting times, as they say, Mariah, and big questions emerge from the gloom as we think about climate change, or maybe out of the bright future we can imagine. Who knows? Dear listener, it turns out that over the past week, Mariah and I have bumped into an article that is very, very thought-provoking, raises big questions. And let me say in a polite way that I don't agree with a lot of the arguments that the article makes. I do think it's worth talking about. It's worth thinking about. And so it's an article. This is an article on a website called Truth Dig. We'll put up the links. But the title of the article is about green-tinted solutions. And these authors make the case that too much of climate activists' thinking is centered on the idea that we can still have it all by replacing fossil fuels with clean electricity and then continue to live our lives just as we do today. Right? In fact, there's quotes about saying, oh, the future will be bright. We're going to turn all of our internal combustion engines into EVs and life goes on. The authors very much disagree with this idea. They call the concept is green growth, which is a buzzword we might bounce back and forth. And just to quote the article, they say, green growth is the idea that the organizing principle of our civilization, endless growth of economies and populations, can be decarbonized swiftly and in a way that will involve no material disruption. Green growth holds out the promise of transitioning from fossil fuels directly into something like an Earth-friendly utopia, without a hitch and without meaningful sacrifice. So there's that claim. I think that might be a little bit of a strong claim, but there is that concept floating around that we're all going to be great if we can just build enough wind turbines. And there you go. This article goes on to make the case that a more important issue even than climate change is essentially materials usage of the planet, that we are despoiling the planet, you know, dumping our plastic in the oceans, you know, consuming land, all kinds of bad things that we're doing that are just unsustainable. Our civilization is unsustainable as it's currently running. And the quote goes, the urgency, this is from the article, the urgency in mainstream circles to deal with greenhouse gas stands in stark contrast to the silence over our ravenous churning through the raw stuff of the planet. There you go. And then finally, they bring up a new word. So we hear this idea of green growth, where we're all going to have pie in the sky when we die, right? Everything's going to be great if we just build wind turbines. They talk about something called degrowth. Degrowth, which is just like the most terrible sort of title for something that you can possibly imagine. But the quote they give us is to say that the degrowthists, that is to say the people who entertain this idea, entertain the heretical idea that a more hopeful future requires more than the hyper-development of green technology to displace fossil fuels. This alternative hopeful future does not maintain GDP growth or strive to constantly increase economic complexity. If we are to avoid ecological collapse, we must take the opposite approach, one of contraction and simplification, a downsizing of the economy and population so that Homo sapiens can prosper within the regenerative and assimilative capacity of the biosphere. In other words, we must live within our planet's biophysical limits. So there's that article. I mean, I have lots of issues with the way the authors have gone about making their case, but I think the major point is a good one. Mariah, did you think that I sort of caught that article? I mean, what's your take on this whole thing?
So, okay. So for starters, we're in a place where climate change has become so widely accepted that we now are debating about what to do about it, right? That's a good thing because, 5 years ago, we were just trying to make it accepted that climate change existed and we needed to do something about it. 5 years ago? I mean, you know, it's been a growing spectrum since James Hansen's 1980 testimony in Congress, right? That's, we've been debating for that long. But, you know, we're now at the point where we're like, okay, now what? We've got this huge problem and how are we going to fix it? And then we have this spectrum of solutions from this idea of sort of the, you know, the green growth. We can keep the economy as we've always had it. Maybe we just need to reimagine capitalism, you know, working within the existing system, or this, you know, sort of opposite end of the spectrum, this green growth, this sort of radical overhaul of the economy to one which measures success not by the gross domestic product, but like gross domestic happiness or some other measure that isn't based on constant consumption of resources. And I think this article does a good job of sort of probing that. And I think these are very, very good, hard questions to ask. And I have green tinted glasses, as the article suggests, right? Like, I mean, I need to look at the future and say, where are the solutions and how do we move toward them? But knowing what the most effective solutions are, especially in our political environment, is a big challenge.
Yeah, I mean, this article posits two sort of extremes. One is what they refer to as green growth, which is this, what they consider the myth that we can have everything as long as we build wind turbines, versus what they call degrowth, which is basically constraining economic activity, stopping all the private jets, right? Downsizing everything and living a more
ending
simple
globalization.
Life.
Ending
globalization, right? Ending globalization and basically challenging the corporate control of our lives, which is like, wow, okay, that's true, right? But those are really starkly different views of the future. And the big question is, are either of those where we're headed? Are we headed somewhere in between? I mean, it's...
Yeah. Well, you know, the article talked about, it cited a quote from a man named Dr. William Rees, who's most notable for he created the ecological footprint analysis, which is the world's best known sustainability indicator. And one of the quotes that came from this Dr. William Rees is, I think, prescient. And I'll read you the quote. It says, "The politically acceptable is ecologically disastrous." True story. "While the ecologically necessary is politically impossible." So if you put that into the context of this article, it's basically saying that this idea of green growth, while it may sound, you know, when you talk about the Green New Deal, when you talk about moving toward wind turbines and renewable energy, it's not actually going to solve the problem, but it's maybe the only one that we can push toward, right? Whereas the ecologically necessary, which in Dr. Rees's perspective, the ecologically necessary is completely getting away from capitalism and moving towards that gross national happiness or towards that, you know, away from endless growth, but that's politically impossible.
Yeah, I mean, it's a huge concept that as we talk, we say we need to end fossil fuels, but I think that what these people are talking about is essentially, as you pointed out, ending the gross national product growth as the measure of our goodness, right? And that the gross national product encompasses lots and lots and lots of things, right? I mean, all aspects of our civilization. And it speaks to this idea that I think they have a name for it, the manufacturing technology.
The MTI, modern techno-industrial.
Okay, modern techno-industrial is
the
problem.
So it's like the growth-based, yeah. Growth-based modern techno-industrial complex.
And it's just consuming the planet. And that's what has to be changed, which is a tall order. I mean, it's really reminiscent of, to my mind, sort of, I wouldn't say, big changes in how we live our lives, which rarely go smoothly, right? I was going to say French Revolution kind of thing, but I mean, they're not implying violence, but they're saying that the changes are so profound that they're almost politically impossible, right? Mm-hmm. Without something else going on. And in fact, some of the references here, Mariah, I think you saw it as well. They basically, in some of the references that are contained in the article, they talk about how millions of people are probably going to die and the remaining few will begin to rebuild the world in a more sensible way.
Well, right. This Dr. William Rees is part of this organization called the Real Green New Deal, or I think it's the realgnd.com is their website. And this website suggests that, renewable energy is not going to fix it for us, and I'm not sure where I picked this fact up, but they say that, 80% of the electricity we use comes from the production of the four material pillars of modern civilization: cement, steel, plastic, and ammonia, which I think ammonia must be nitrogen for fertilizer. I'm not positive about that, but so that's 80% of our electricity demand comes from those four things. And they're, essentially saying like, well, we'd have to just stop using all of those four things if we wanted to be 100% renewable energy.
Yeah. Yes. I mean, I had I hit that same quote about where the energy demand is. I couldn't buy that number. It seemed like it was, but it does make, I mean, the article that we're sort of using as a leapfrog basically said that the Green New Deal, oh, you silly Green New Dealers, haven't thought about how to get the carbon dioxide out of cement production, right? That has nothing to do with fossil fuels. You must, but you don't have a plan to address that. That's not quite true. Yeah. That's the most dour take on things that the and I think it's part of the problem I have with the article. It is conveniently using facts to sort of paint a picture that says when, you know, our current path is not a good one.
I think, like you said, that's definitely needs to be fact checked for sure in the article. But I think that this website, the Real Green New Deal website, you know, you had mentioned that they're talking about sort of the collapse of society. And they're saying, you know, because of these kinds of issues, you know, the massive need for electricity that we have, there's just no way we can move forward. And, you know, one of the things that their website says is, look, we're just all going to crash and burn. And there's going to be like a little subset of us that, you know, survives and moves forward in this new way that has nothing to do with capitalism and an economic society based on, you know, GDP or GNP.
It sounds like preppers, you know, these people that have a spider hole in the backyard to hide in. There is an interesting discussion around a scientist. I think his name is Mark Jacobson.
Mark Jacobson out of Stanford University.
Who has done research saying that the United States could power all of its electrical needs with renewable energies and batteries. And, you know, you could build a system where there's no fossil fuel needed. I always interpreted that as to say that was technically doable, but was not an implied promise that we would all, our lives would be the same as they are today. We'd all drive electric vehicles and sit in traffic jams with electric vehicles, right, instead of internal combustion vehicles. That's kind of a misreading of what Jacobson's saying. But this article is challenging whether or not it's even feasible for renewable energies to provide enough electricity in a way that the planet can sustain, because they run off and say, well, you're going to need all this lithium and cobalt, and how terrible is that? And I mean, that's where I get into there are questions about how to build and sustain a renewable energy economy. But my take on it is that things are much more fluid than this article presents, and that the idea that we could power ourselves with wind turbines, everything that we would need in 2030, is good news, but that does not constrain us to necessarily do that. And we might find other paths forward where there is less dependence on capitalism or more, communalism. I don't want to say communism, but communalism, right? Where people
shared economy.
Is that fair? I mean, what did you think of the references to Jacobson?
Okay. So, I got to speak with Mark Jacobson for my book, actually, which was great. He's worked with a website called the Solutions Project. You can go onto that website and you can click on any state in the country. And actually, I think he's expanded it to, I don't know what the number is now, but 130 countries around the world. And he breaks down exactly what sort of portfolio of renewable energy you would need and how you would go about getting that for your state, right? Because it's going to be different based on, you know, geography and the climate of your particular area, the wind and solar. And his model is 100% wind, water, solar, no nuclear is part in that. That's his renewable energy basis. And it's often referred to as sort of the path forward. His research is extensive and, you know, peer reviewed and very detailed. And essentially, you know, he says we have the technological and economic incentives, you know, ability to move forward with 100%. What we lack is the social and political will to move forward. So he says that's the biggest obstacle. But there was the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences article. There was a PNAS article written about sort of criticizing some of Jacobson's work, saying that, you know, there were invalid models. He used invalid modeling tools. There were modeling errors, and that there were implausible and inadequately supported assumptions. So it was basically saying, no, we can't there, you know, we don't have the technological capability to move towards 100% wind, water, and solar the way that Jacobson has proposed. And I think that's a, I think that's something we do need to look very, very hard at, because this idea of green growth is predicated on us having the ability to move forward with wind, water, and solar.
But I mean, I guess the idea that we could provide enough electricity from renewable sources, I think that's different from the idea or the sort of the mental mindset that there will be no change to the way we live, right? Those are different things. And it seems to me that the, you know, what are the changes to the way we live? Well, I mean, one simple change, again, I'm trying to translate this for myself, but it's like, I can see a future where we have more long distance trains with, you know, electric trains. We have electrified mass transit in our major cities, right? That's a future that we could power. It's dramatically different from where we are today, right? If you have to take a train to Chicago instead of flying to Chicago, that's a change. I mean, is it like the a downgrade of civilization? I don't know. Right.
Yeah. Well,
and you got to keep those things in mind, I think. And the real question is, what is your mental image of what life's going to be like in 2040?
Right. Well, and I mean, I think the other question is, will that be politically acceptable if that proposition is made? Another article that the Truth Dig brought up was some research from academics in Australia, Patrick Moriarty and Damon Hannery, from a 2016 to 2020 study, where it said that we'll have to use 50% less energy to be 100% renewable, and globalization will have to end, right? So, you know, their assertion is exactly what you're saying. If we, maybe we can move forward on 100% renewable energy, but we have to drastically reduce our consumption of energy, which is going to be an overhaul of our lifestyle. Are we willing to do that?
Well, and I think the kinds of questions the article raises is, will the corporate structures that we live within, will they allow that, right? Will they accept, I mean, will the airline, for example, again, just thinking of the big changes, would the airline industry accept taxes on flying so massive as to basically kill the airline industry, right? Would that happen? Could that happen? You know, I mean, that's your quote about the politically unacceptable, you know, the environmentally necessary is politically impossible, right? And maybe that's where the battle is, to open the ground for discussions about how to allow these other systems to take shape.
Yeah, it's a big and hard question.
Yeah, I mean, it's yeah, I mean, and I think that there are. There are, so as we start out saying, there's a range of options, right? There's different, it's just like everyone has a personality, how they want to view the problem, right? There's people who are more pessimistic and think everything's going to fall apart and we need to, you know, and cut back on, this is the degrowth people, which I mean, I don't disagree with them, but they also sort of, to me, come across as people that want to make you eat your peas, right? It's like, we need to cut down everything and we need to live more simply. I don't think people want to wear ash cloth and, you know, walk around and necessarily grow their own food, right? Although it might be the direction we're heading in. I have a feeling there's some middle ground that with enough pressure from below, structures will establish that are less capitalistic and more, I keep saying communal, and I guess I'm trying to shy away. There's so many buzzwords in American society. I mean, socialism, right? I would like to see all the electric power system, all the utilities, say in Massachusetts, become public entities that are not owned for profit, right? Some investor's ox is going to get gored if that happens, right? But that's a change. That's sort of a step away from the kind of capitalistic models we've had for a long time. And I think you probably imagine a bunch of examples like that. And is that where as I say, the effort has to be put to sort of make that normal. Put us back 5 years where we're trying to convince people that climate change is real. Okay, now they say it's real. And now we're going to say, oh, yeah. And another thing, capitalism has to change, right? And I mean, do you think that's even plausible? I mean, are we, you and I, going to go down in history as Karl Marx and Engels and Marx calling for?
I mean, I just can't, that quote that I, you know, that we said earlier, I just think that really gets at a lot of it, that, I don't know, the politically acceptable is ecologically disastrous. So I, you know, I don't know if there's a middle ground. I'd like to think so, because that's, you know, that's what I get up every morning and keep chasing. So,
well, I mean, I think that, I mean, this kind of thing bears continuing discussion, because we spoke with an author named Justin Bean last week, who was proposing ways to think about the future, right? That we are now, given the advent of the Inflation Reduction Act, where there's going to be real changes to the power industry, things are happening at the federal government to address climate change. The question is how those things get channeled, what kind of future we want to build. Again, maybe that's the thing that I have with this article and a lot of this talk, is that they all have almost this Marxian theory of history, that we're all inevitably headed towards something, right? We're all going to be crowded around a campfire after civilization collapses, or we're all going to be in, you know, corporate slavery. I think none of that's true. I mean, what's going to happen is what we build, right? So the question is, what do we want to build, and how do we approach it, and what humane good things do we want to include in the solution, and how do we make those things happen sooner rather than later?
Yeah.
That makes sense?
Yeah, a good positive view of this, of a sustainable future, for sure.
So, Mariah, I think we have to come back to this topic. There's too many loose ends here. What we'll do is we'll put up links to the article and some of these other articles we've made reference to. Please read it and think about it, because this, we are shaping the future by how we think about it, what we accept. And if we stay in a mental mindset that says the corporations are going to save us, that's probably not going to work any more than more dour outlooks, right? Mm. All right. Well, we will put it down there, Mariah, although we'll come back. We'll put up the links to all of this crazy stuff. And believe me, if you read it, send us an email. Tell us what you think. You can come on the show and explain it all to us, because this is complicated stuff. Check the link. They'll be on the blog at massclimateaction.org, right? You look at the blog. It says newsletter and more in the banner. Pull that down, and it says blog and podcast. That'll get you into the links. Of course, you can pick up the Just Streaming show on any of the modern podcast distribution apps that you probably already are familiar with, from Stitcher to Google to Apple. Please ask all of your friends to listen to us on their modern podcast distribution apps. I want to thank our good friend D.R. Tucker for sending us useful links week after week. We really appreciate it. And we want to, if you want to send us an email, tell us what you think about green growth versus degrowth, send us an email to podcast@massclimateaction.net. Let us know what you think. So we'll close where we always close, by saying that we recognize the necessity of personal accountability, that we accept responsibility for building a durable future, and that we believe it's a patriotic duty of citizens to speak out. Because of all those things, we have to insist that the United States transform its energy sector over the next 7 years under a just and equitable plan that uses regulation, investment, and a price on carbon that respects environmental justice communities. So, Mariah, thank you for wandering through this philosophical minefield with me. It's been interesting.
It's fascinating. Thank you for having me.
Thanks to everyone for listening as we wandered through. I don't think we blew anything up this time, but thanks to everyone for listening. We'll talk again soon. Bye-bye.
Very cool.